Yeah, before I begin, I would remind you that I'm expecting a paper as part of the requirements for the course. Some of you have already talked to me about topics and sources. Those of you that have not, I would encourage you to come up with a topic before too much longer. I always prefer for people to themselves become interested in the topic and choose it without my prompting. If you are completely stumped, however, I'm of course happy to make some suggestions. So, last time I was discussing the return to the manifest plane of the 12th Imam and not quite completed that narrative. I believe I've broken off with an evocation of the killing of the personage known as Sufyan, the descendant of the Umayyads, who appears in Damascus, and as the opponent of the Imam al-Mahdi, summons people to loyalty to him. However, a group of followers of the Imam arising from Iran are sent to Damascus, from the seat of government of the Imam in Kufa, kill Sufyani and put an end to this challenge to the rule of the Imam. This, of course, being a very clear illustration of the general principle that I put forward, that in all of these narratives one sees a replay, an echo of earlier history, except, of course, that the outcome of the events and now take place is exactly the opposite of the events upon which they are modeled, the original events on which they are modeled. It is approximately this time, and again, because one does not have a complete consecutive narrative, it's simply a question of piecing together the indications of different hadith. It's approximately this time there takes place also the appearance of two antonymous figures, two contradictory figures, Jesus, the second coming of Jesus, and the emergence of the figure called the Dajjal. And I've already spoken of these two. The existence of Jesus and his polar opposite, the Antichrist, the Dajjal, was taken by Shia theologians as one argument for the existence of the occulted Imam, that is to say, already established in Islamic belief before the occultation of the 12th Imam, was a belief in two figures whose lives were preternaturally prolonged, Jesus and the Dajjal. It appears that Jesus comes somewhat later than the appearance of the 12th Imam. Again, some caution is indicated because we do not have a precise chronology, we do not have a carefully constructed narrative. It is said that Jesus will appear in Palestine at a place called Atir. And from there, he will go to another location in Palestine, near the city of Lydda, still existing city in occupied Palestine, to confront the Dajjal. It is time now to say a little bit more about the Dajjal. We have said already that he may well be translated or described as the Antichrist, because his fuller designation in Islamic terminology is precisely Al-Masih Ad-Dajjal. Al-Masih Ad-Dajjal, Al-Masih being one of the Quranic attributes given to Jesus, and obviously cognate with Messiah. Al-Masih Ad-Dajjal. As for the word Dajjal, we cannot be sure about its precise sense or etymology. It appears to be a proper name more than anything else. However, most commonly, it is connected to an Arabic root meaning deception. And clearly, the Dajjal engages in mass deception. As already suggested, his deception consists primarily of pseudo-miraculous deeds that parody the miracles, the authentic miracles of Jesus. they have a satanic rather than a divine inspiration. They are not, however, a mere optical illusion. It is said that 70,000 people will crowd around him when he appears, also it would seem, in the general region of Palestine or Syria. Here we have another topographical detail. If on the one hand we find people coming from certain regions of Iran to swear their loyalty to the Mahdi, it has to be reported that a large number of people come from Isfahan in order to support, to give their support to the Dajjal. So no cause here for local patriotism if you're an Isfahani. It also has to be said that according to the relevant traditions, a disproportionately large number of the followers of the Dajjal will be women. And they will crowd around the Dajjal, this 70,000 people, this group of 70,000. And initially he will appear to be extremely successful. He will conquer a large body of territory, a large swathe of territory. However, he will be unable to enter any of the cities where the imams are buried, that is Najaf, Karbala, Qazvin, Samarra, and Medina, and likewise he will be unable to enter Mecca. So all of the significant locations in the sacred geography of Shiism and Islam more generally will be immune from or invulnerable to attack by the Dajjal. He meets his downfall at the hands of Jesus. Here again, one has a certain number of contradictory reports in the hadith literature. In some hadith, the killing of the Dajjal is attributed not to Jesus, but rather to the Mahdi himself, the Prophet Muhammad. In other words, the primacy of the Mahdi in this scenario at the end of time must be preserved in this matter also. Then what one might call a compromise or a bridging of the two possibilities, it is said in other hadith that indeed it is Jesus who kills the Dajjal, but he does so on behalf of and on the orders of the Imam of the Mahdi. In any event, after the Dajjal is put to death and his following is dispersed, and here we come to a significant detail on which there's no difference of opinion, Jesus will go to the Masjid al-Aqsa in Jerusalem. The Masjid al-Aqsa. That location from which the Prophet departed on his night journey, his ascension to the Divine Presence shortly before the migration from Makkah to Medina. And it is to the Masjid al-Aqsa that Jesus will go, and at the time of prayer. And the Imam, and here we do not mean the Mahdi, we mean simply the person who is appointed to lead the prayers at the Masjid al-Aqsa, so let us say the prayer leader, will defer to Jesus and invite him to lead the prayer. However, he will decline, Jesus will decline, and insist on praying behind the existing prayer leader of the Masjid al-Aqsa. The significance of this detail is, of course, the fulfillment of Quranic prophecy, in the sense that Jesus is already portrayed in the Quran as, of course, being a Muslim. Not in the sense of Muslim with capital M, i.e., one acquainted with and propagating all of the doctrines and the ordinances of Islam, but in the essential and underlying sense of one who preaches submission to the revealed will of God. This inherent Islam of Jesus, Islam with a small I in that sense of submission, But now manifests itself in his outer Islam, with a capital I, in other words, that he, by the act of praying at the Masjid al-Aqsa, proclaims that he is himself a follower of the Quranic revelation. And as a confirmation thereof, he will again forswear all of the doctrines ascribed to him by Christianity, which of course also we find in the Quran itself, the doctrine of the sonship, the doctrine of the Trinity. These are refuted by Jesus in the Quran, in other words, verses in the Quran, attribute to Jesus the refutation, the rejection of these doctrines, and now again after his return, he will refute and take distance himself from the notion that he's the Son of God in any sense, and therefore also he will declare the nullity of the doctrine of the Trinity. And as an outward sign of this, it is said that he will break the crucifix. That he will break the crucifix. Whether or not this be taken in a literal sense, that every existing crucifix will be gathered in and destroyed, is really beside the point. The symbolic sense is, however, entirely clear. But that the central symbol of Christianity, which is the associated with Jesus, will be refuted by him, so that the crucifixion, both as a historical event, will be denied, and the beliefs such as salvation, redemption, and so forth, founded on that event, which is from the point of view of Islam an imaginary event, will also be denied. So therefore, a second coming of Jesus, and we have to concede that that term second coming is of course a borrowing from Christian terminology, but a second coming that involves in effect a final refutation of Christianity at the hands of the person to whom it is above all attributed. It is said that thereafter Jesus will live on for additional 40 years. He will die and be buried in Medina next to the Prophet. So again, the theme of association with Islam, the acceptance of Islam on the part of Jesus after the Second Coming. As for the remaining life and career of the Imam al-Mahdi, return to manifestation, here again we are at the mercy of varying traditions. The most common tradition specifies that he will live and rule with absolute justice throughout the world for a period of 309 years. Why precisely 309? No immediate explanation occurs to me. But it is obvious that here again we are dealing with an unusually prolonged lifespan, although this time of course a prolonged lifespan on earth, not in occultation. During this period it is said that absolute justice will prevail upon earth and that Islam will be universally embraced. In explanation of this triumph of the Imam al-Mahdi, verse 82 of chapter 3 of the Quran is sometimes adduced, which reads approximately, whatever is in the heavens and the earth will submit, or has submitted. The verb in Arabic may be interpreted in either sense, maybe either a past or a future, or for that matter a present. But in the context with which we are dealing, you might as well translate it as a future. So let us say they will submit whatever is in the heavens and the earth voluntarily or unwillingly, and to him they shall be brought back. They will submit everything in the heavens and the earth voluntarily or unwillingly. Notice two things here. Firstly, the heavens and the earth. We've already suggested that the function of the 12th Imam can be deduced from some of the earlier hadith that we refer to as not simply universal, i.e. global, but also cosmic in a certain sense. His manifestation, his return to manifestation, illumines the whole of the cosmos. Remember the columns of light rising up from the courtyard of the Kaaba when he proclaims himself. Second point to note is the expression voluntarily or unwillingly, taw'an wa karhan, voluntarily or unwillingly. And this is an indication, according to Shi'i commentators upon this verse, although not all of them, that there are those that will willingly submit and others who will not. And that therefore, Imam al-Mahdi, in his, is not simply entitled, but is indeed obliged by virtue of his mission, to compel submission to the order of justice that he establishes. So that we have, in fact, as one of the subsidiary designations of the Imam al-Mahdi, Sahib al-Saif, the wielder of the sword, the one who carries the sword. And the mention of the sword appears also in some other hadith. Remember, some of the hadith concerning the Imam al-Mahdi as the Qa'im, the one who will arise, referred to him as al-Qa'im the Saif, the one who will arise with the sword. And then finally, the ayah concludes, or this portion of the verse concludes, and to him they will be brought back. And to him they will be brought back. That is, to God they will be brought back. If we interpret this final portion of the verse in the context of the renewed appearance of the Mahdi, it means, of course, that after all things in the heavens and the earth have submitted voluntarily or otherwise to him, then they will be brought back to Allah. In other words, resurrection will take place, and the history of the world will finally be brought to an end. But as for the period between these two events, the establishment of the universal rule of the Mahdi and the occurrence of resurrection, nothing definite can be said. Before moving on from this verse, it should be pointed out, of course, that there are other possible interpretations that coexist with this. I'm going to be talking very shortly about the traditions of Quranic exegesis of Tafsir. Particularly Shi'i Tafsir, it is to some extent the case also with Sunni Tafsir, exegesis of the Quran. Verses have permissibly more than one interpretation. It's not a question always of choosing one to the exclusion of others. And we can exemplify this with respect to this particular verse. In other words, another interpretation which does not negate the one that I put forward is the following: that whatever is in the heavens and the earth, i.e. the entirety of creation, has already submitted. In other words, the verse in itself is capable of being read in the past tense, aslana. Everything is already submitted. Willingly or unwillingly? Willingly, in the sense of those human beings who accept divine guidance, who embrace Islam, attempt to orient their lives accordingly. Unwillingly, in the case of inanimate beings that lack the capacity of free will and therefore the ability to choose or to reject. Unwillingly, that is to say, inherently, with respect to the material composition of their beings, they are subject to the laws of divine creation. So this is also another possible interpretation of that verse. It should not be thought that when we put forward an interpretation that is, as it were, specifically Shi'i, that has particular relevance to one of the distinctive Shi'i themes of Shi'ism, this is the only interpretation, even from the point of view of Shi'i commentary upon the Quran. Finally, with respect to the whole question of the 12th Imam and his return, maybe a few comparative remarks would be useful. For the following reason, that the whole concept of the Mahdi whether the Sunni or the Shi'i, with which we've been primarily concerned, that cannot be authenticated directly from the Quran. In other words, it requires a work of exegetical labor, such as that which we have just engaged in, to derive from verses of the Quran something about the coming of the Imam. There is clearly no direct reference. The only possible exception being verse 80 of chapter 11, which I did talk about previously, where there is the mention of Baqiyatullah, as it were, the remnant of, literally the remnant of God, in other words, that remnant, that final human exemplar of the will to guide mankind. Apart from these indirect allusions in the Quran, the entirety of the concept is derived from Hadith. Hadith is in the Prophet, or in the case of Shia Islam, the Imams. And therefore, the question has been raised, initially of course by Western scholars and then by some skeptical Muslims, about the possibility of extra-Islamic influences on this whole concept of a savior figure that will arise at the end of time. I certainly do not have the confidence to analyze in any detail Jewish or Christian beliefs in this respect. But there are some obvious differences which I think discourage the idea of a borrowing from either Christianity or Judaism into Islam. As far as Judaism is concerned, then clearly the Messiah is not yet born, although apparently there was someone in New York who, until a few years ago, claimed in fact to be the Messiah, the Lubavitcher rabbi, but apparently he didn't gain too wide a following. In any event, he is not yet born. And when he comes, he will be, his mission will be essentially a narrowly defined national, always supposing that one accepts views as constituting a distinct nation. He will be, as it were, a national or a savior, not endowed with any universal mission. His concern will be, in the first place, to take over Palestine and to expel its population, which explains why some Orthodox rabbis are opposed to Zionism. Zionism is seen as having jumped the gun, as it were. The Messiah is not yet there, and in advance of that, some important individuals have attempted to undertake the task reserved for him. As for the Christian concept of the second coming of Jesus, a term which I freely used in reference to Islam, again I must confess a lack of profound competence in this area, but it seems that the primary purpose for the second coming of Jesus is the redemption of the individual believer, the final cleansing of man, of the original sin with which, according to Christianity, he is burdened. Not, however, the construction of a universal social order. It may be useful as well to make here a general point before moving on. If we say that the whole belief in the Prophet Imam and in his return cannot be authenticated with reference to the Quran except certain verses subjected to interpretation of the type that I've just demonstrated, this does not mean that the doctrine is inherently dubious or inauthentic. It's an important point to remember, not only with respect to Shia Islam, but Islam in general, that the entirety of Islam is not to be found directly and clearly in the Quran. Directly, clearly, and explicitly. Of course, the Quran is the bedrock of Islam for Muslims of all persuasions and schools of thought. And everything ultimately goes back to or proceeds from the Quran. But that is the whole point, that there are matters which go back to and proceed from the Quran and are not clearly and distinctly present there. To give another entirely unrelated, but nonetheless important for example, the manner in which the prayer is to be performed. The Quran contains injunctions for the prayer. It also indicates some of the postures that are to be assumed in the prayer, bowing, prostrating, standing. However, the sequence of postures to be assumed in the prayer and the recitations that are to be made in the prayer, this is not clearly contained in the Quran. But who would deny that these are part of Islam? Clearly they are, for all schools of thought within Islam. And this simple and yet fundamental example establishes for us, I think, a general principle that one may not simply open the Quran and look for a certain topic, a certain doctrine, a certain belief, and are not finding it there in concrete, explicit form. Well, this is nothing to do with Islam, it must have come from somewhere else. This is not the case. Clearly, one has to look carefully at the Quran together with the supplementary sources to which the Quran points, above all, the Sunnah of the Prophet and for Shia Islam, the Twelve Imams. So this brings to an end our review of the lives, careers of the Imams and the anticipated return of the Twelfth Imam. What we have time left for in the balance of this course is a survey of some of the main developments in Shia Islam after the beginning of the Great Rock Occultation, which is of course chronologically a far longer period than the period during which the Imams were upon earth. So there is, as it were, a great imbalance. At least from the chronological point of view, we will have spent much longer time on a shorter period. We're going to spend much less time on a longer period. However, the imbalance is justified in that, of course, the lives, the sayings of the Imams, the whole concept of the Imami is of fundamental importance. And it can be said that after the beginning of the occultation, what occurs within the Shia community is a working out in varying ways of that which was established and laid down by the Imams themselves. In a way, and this is only an incomplete analogy, it can be said that after the beginning of the occultation, the Shia community found itself in something of the same position as did the broader Muslim community after the death of the Prophet. Why? Because there is no longer present upon earth in manifest and accessible form a ma'asum, a possessor of the quality of inerrance and infallibility. And we find sometimes cited in explanation of the shared predicament of the absence of a ma'asum, the hadith, that the scholars are heirs to the Prophet. This is the hadith of the Prophet himself. The scholars are heirs to the Prophet. Al-ulama warathat al-anbiya. Scholars are heirs to the Prophet.
Of course, it's precisely what do they inherit? This is a matter of interpretation. But if one interprets the hadith in its broadest sense from the point of view of the religious history of Islam, it can be said that the custodianship of religion after the end of prophethood is vested in the religious scholars. One can make a very good argument, in fact, that Islamic history is above all the history of Islamic scholarship and the cultivation and transmission of religious knowledge. Dynastic battles are peripheral to this essential core of Islamic history. And if one applies this hadith to the case of Shia Islam, then one would say that the scholars in question, who are the heirs to the Prophet, are in the first place the Imams themselves. that is to say the category of those who are scholars or ulama, are not, to begin with, as it were, professional scholars of religion. They are rather the imams. Because the word scholar, or the word that I'm translating as scholar, simply means one endowed with the knowledge of religion. However, after the beginning of the greater occultation, the scholars in question, the ulama, are quite simply the professional scholars of religion. Those who engage in the study of the religious sciences, and thereby act as heirs for the Prophet and also for the Imams before him. After him. We also have to qualify the analogy that I've drawn by pointing out that the emergence of a religious class, that is to say a class of religious scholars in Shia Islam, does not wait upon the beginning of the occultation. The beginnings of the learned class within the Shia community can definitely be traced to the period of the Imams themselves, beginning with Imam Ali. And then picking up with particular speed in the times of the 5th and 6th Imams, Muhammad al-Baqir and Ja'far al-Sadiq. So the germ of the religious class, the origin of the religious class, is there already in the time of the Imams. However, it comes forward, develops after the beginning of the occultation. What I would like to do is now to survey in succession the principal forms of religious knowledge that were cultivated by the religious scholars after the onset of the greater occultation. Today, if I have time, I will deal with two of them, closely related, Tafsir and Hadith. Tafsir, exegesis, commentary upon the Quran, the understanding of the Quran. Hadith, of course, the sayings, the recorded sayings, utterances of the Prophet in the first place, and then also the 12 Imams from his household. So we'll begin with the Tafsir. At the very outset of this course, or very close to the outset of this course, I have cited for you the well-known hadith that is called the Hadith of Saqalain, the hadith concerning the two valuable entities. Remember, according to this hadith, which is to be found in Sunni as well as Shi'i sources, the Prophet is recorded as having said that I shall leave with you two entities of great value, the Book of God and my progeny. They shall never be separated. If you hold fast to them, you shall not go astray. There are multiple applications of this hadith. There are two that are relevant to concern right now. Firstly, it conveys confers upon the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt a particular and unique authority in the understanding and interpretation of the Quran. The fact that they are together must, among other things, mean this. Then, in addition, it means that the true meaning of the Quran, which the exposition of which is the unique privilege of the Imams, must also remain available at all times. If you think it through, this is a corollary of the belief in the permanence of the Imamate, the principle that the earth cannot ever be empty of a Hujjah. If the Hujjah, the proof of God, the proof of His will to guide mankind, is always present, even under the conditions of occultation, and if in turn one of the privileged functions of the Hujjah is the interpretation of the Quran. That means also that the meaning, the authentic and true and complete meaning of the Quran must also at all times be existing. So if the imamate is there, then by as it is according to Shia belief, then also the meaning of the Quran, which is expounded by the imams, the true meaning, the true comprehensive meaning, must also, as it were, be there. It must be available. In view of this, sometimes we find the imams being described not simply as the expositors of Quranic meaning, they are themselves described as a book. However, a book that speaks. A book that speaks. The Quran is described as the silent book, because as a book, well, clearly it has no tongue with which to express itself. Although you may of course say that clearly, as the word of God, it is endowed with speech. But in a more obvious and accessible sense, then, you know, clearly it is a silent book. And the imams, by contrast, are described as the speaking word of God. I'm sorry, the speaking book of God. Kitabullah an-Natiq. The speaking book of God, or the book of God endowed with speech. It is as if the imams endow the Quran with speech. So the whole question of tafsir, the understanding of the Quran, is an important characteristic of Shiism in general. Another distinguishing characteristic of tafsir as cultivated in Shia Islam is the discovery in the Quran of references, in almost all cases indirect, to the imams themselves, the institution of the imamate, the duty of obeying them, and of dissociating oneself from the enemies of the imam. There is a saying, let me see if I can find it. There's a saying attributed to the fifth imam, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir, in which he said, always supposing the hadith to be authentic, the Quran was sent down in thirds. The Quran was sent down in thirds, i.e. in three major components. One third concerning us and those we love. One third concerning our enemies and the enemies of those who were before us, and one third concerning laws. Now the division of the subject matter of the Quran into these three does not mean that the Quran is quantitatively divided into three equal parts, but we may regard this as the discernment within the Quran of three principal themes, or three principal foci around which the subsidiary topics of the Quran are clustered. Us and those we love. Once it is said by the Imam that one third of the Quran concerns us and those we love, well, this might appear to be, on the one hand, self-aggrandizement, and on the other hand, an arbitrary reading of Quranic narratives where other individuals are very clearly mentioned. Earlier prophets, for example, and those who opposed them. However, the understanding of the matter is the following, that the individuals mentioned in earlier, the individuals mentioned in the Quran from earlier generations, prophets before the prophet, their successors, those who followed them, their enemies, all of these represent that same opposition of principles which we find in the lives of the imams themselves. In other words, preceding prophets are simply a manifestation of, well, I should probably delete the word simply, let us say a manifestation of the divine will to guide, justice, legitimacy, all of those positive values that are associated the prophethood and the imami. And likewise, their opponents are seen to be the earlier manifestation, the manifestation in earlier history of unbelief, injustice, rejection, illegitimacy, and so forth. All of those countervalues that are associated with the enemies of the imams. So from this point of view, the discerning in the Quran of multiple references to the imams and those we love is not improbable. It moreover goes together with another important principle of, a distinctive principle of Shi'i Tashbih, that each verse of the Quran is of continuing relevance. In other words, although many verses of the Quran are revealed concerning, shall we say, Moses, the opposition that he faced, the preliminary earthly career of Jesus as a prophet, and even the struggles of the prophet and his companions in his lifetime, but even though verses have that obvious point of reference, still this does not exhaust their meaning. And that those verses continue to have a significance that is beyond the historical or the antiquarian. The same hadith that I just cited from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir continues as follows. He says, were a verse to die with the people concerning whom it was sent down, nothing would remain of the Quran. Were a verse to die with the people concerning whom it was sent down, nothing would remain of the Quran. So that the occasion for the revelation of a verse, a particular circumstance in the life of the prophet, or a narrative concerning one of the earlier prophets, this does not exhaust the actual meaning and relevance of the verse. It has a continuing relevance and applicability. The hadith continues, rather, the beginning of the Quran continues, as does its end, so long as the heavens and earth shall continue. To every people belongs a verse which they follow and in accordance with which they continue to live in good fortune or misfortune. The beginning of the Quran continues as does its end, so long as the heavens and the earth shall continue. In other words, each portion of the Quran continues to be not simply fixed as textually as part of the Quran, but as having relevance and applicability. And to every people belongs the verse, that is to say, to every people, to every group of persons, people here is a general term, in Arabic poem, not narrowly defined, belongs the verse which they follow. In other words, every people at every age, if they search, they will find in the Quran a verse, or more than a verse, according to which they may orient their lives. Therefore, tafsir has among its purposes the discovery of that which is of immediate and continuing relevance and applicability. Which goes together with what we have already said, namely that the meaning of the Quran as a totality is by definition available. It is available, which does not mean to say that everyone knows it or that access to it is easily had. However, it is, as a matter of principle, available. Why? Because the Imam is, the Hujjah is still in existence. So this is one of the important characteristics of Shi'i Tafsir. Another characteristic which we have already touched upon is the existence of different levels of meaning within the Quranic text. There are various schemes which I have put before you. The basic one is the simplest, that there is an outer meaning, the zahir, and then the inner meaning, the batin.
And this division, which goes back to a universally accepted hadith, one will find also in certain types of Sunni commentary upon the Quran, especially commentaries written by Sufis, whose concern it is to discover the batin, the inward meaning. In addition to this twofold scheme, there is the fourfold scheme that I put before you already when speaking about Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq. I don't wish to repeat that now, simply to remind you that there was such a scheme put before you. Four levels of meaning. And then later we have even a sevenfold scheme put forward. The important matter to retain is not how many levels or the names given to each of these levels, but rather the multiplicity of levels of meaning contained within the Quran. And one of the distinctive characteristics of Shi'i tafsir is a heightened awareness of this multiplicity of levels of meaning, which in the Sunni sphere is to be found only among Sufi commentators. It is necessary to maybe to correlate with Zahir and Batin two terms which are particular to Shi'i tafsir. Tanzil of course means revelation. Which is one of the Quranic terms meaning revelation, the sending down of the book. In this context, however, it has a somewhat different meaning. It means, quite simply, the outer meaning, that which is immediately accessible to anyone that has a competent knowledge of the Arabic language. The ta'wil is the obviously enough is the inward meaning or the process of discovering the inward meaning and corresponds therefore to Batin. However, we must add that there is a secondary and related meaning of Ta'wil. Fulfillment of prophecy. And the ayah that I cited at the end of the discussion of the Prophet Imam is an excellent example of that. Oh, that ayah, it was submit to him all that is in the heavens and the earth, verse 82 of chapter 3, what we engaged in there was precisely ta'wil. Ta'wil in the two meanings. It is an inner meaning, obviously enough, when you first read that verse. You will not think of the coming or the return of the Mahdi, of the 12th Imam. This is not something that can be deduced from the outer meaning. It is an inner meaning, and therefore is an instance of Ta'wil. But also, Ta'wil has the component of prophecy and the fulfillment of prophecy. Insofar as the return of the 12th Imam is obviously not yet accomplished, therefore that verse 82 of chapter 3 is an example of ta'wil, that is to say, it points to a future event. So we can say in summary that ta'wil is an inward meaning, and especially it is an inward meaning that points to an event in future time. Um,
Before we review the history of Shi'i tafsir and some of its principal texts, or a couple of other necessary remarks, the question of whether indeed the text of the Quran has been retained, been preserved precisely as revealed. A matter, of course, which is highly sensitive and is often raised in polemics between Sunnis and Shi'is. The opinion of the overwhelming majority of Shi'i scholars is that the Quranic text, which is generally known as the Uthmanic recension, because the text was drawn up and standardized in the time of the third caliph of Uthman, the opinion of the overwhelming majority of Shi'i scholars is indeed that the that text is fully authentic. And indeed, it will be difficult to argue otherwise, given that the Quran itself contains a guarantee of its own preservation. If one accepts the fundamental premise of Islamic belief that the Quran is a revealed book, we have in the Quran a verse that says, certainly it is we who sent it down, and we who shall preserve it. Therefore, to hypothesize a distortion of the text would run against the logic of that verse. We do, however, find a minority of scholars who suggest that at the level of ta'wil, the Quran has been distorted. I hope you appreciate the distinction. At the level of tanzil, i.e. the text, no distortion has taken place. However, at the level of ta'wil, that is to say, inward meaning, the inward meanings, such as that which I have suggested for that particular verse, has been either suppressed or distorted. Sometimes, too, one finds speculation on minor changes in spelling in the Quran, which would yield, from the Shi'i point of view, significant results. Unfortunately, I don't have the exact verse in mind, its number, but there is a verse which addresses the Muslims as being the best of nations or the best of groups ever raised for mankind. And there the word in Arabic is Ummah.
Kuntum khayra ummatin, what's suggested there? You are the best people, the best religious community following the Prophet raised for mankind, Ummah. Some Shi'i commentators suggest an alternative reading in there. As you can see, the orthographic difference is quite slight from Umma to Imna. Imna being the plural in Arabic of Imam, so that then the addressees of the verse become the Imams of the Assembly. And the meaning of the verse would be that you are the best of imams ever raised. In other words, the preceding prophet has a series of imams, successors, expounding his legacy. But you, imams from the household of the prophet, are better than all preceding ones. This kind of alternate reading, based upon slight orthographic difference, is to be encountered, but again, its significance should not be overestimated. It is something that exists on the margins of Shi'i tafsir. And generally speaking, Shi'i tafsir bases itself entirely upon the existing recension of the Quran and does not, at the textual level, cast any doubt upon its integrity. In fact, and this is a feature of Shi'i scholarship in general, the commentaries written upon the Quran by Shi'i commentators are replete with cross-references to Sunni authorities. This is significant from a number of points of view. Firstly, it shows that despite the growing divergence between Sunni and Shi'i traditions,
there was not a complete mutual rejection on the at least on the level of scholarship. Virtually every Shi'i book of Tafsir contains references to the corresponding Sunni sources. Sometimes it is true in order to refute what they say, but by no means always. On matters that are entirely neutral, and they constitute in fact the great bulk of the exegetical problems in the Quran, the views of Sunni scholars are cited as authoritative. For example, when it comes to the simple explanation of words, words that are unusual or that have in the Quran a special meaning, then Sunni authorities are cited quite freely. It could not be said, however, that the reverse is the case. If one looks at Sunni commentaries upon the Quran, very rarely are Shi'i cited, and if they are, it is almost always for refutation, for polemical purposes. And this, I think, simply reflects the minority status of Shi'is within the overall Islamic community. As the minority, they had reason to be aware of the literature, the teachings, the scholarly traditions of the surrounding majority, whereas the surrounding majority, because of its numerical preponderance, and maybe other reasons too, did not feel a similar need. And the same is the case in virtually every branch of religious knowledge. And this, you know, continues down to the present, by finding the Shi'i ulama being well acquainted, Shi'i religious scholars being well acquainted with Sunni literature and traditions of law and hadith and exegesis, whereas the reverse, despite some slight advance in recent decades, is generally speaking not the case. So let us now look at the main stages of the Tafsir literature in Shia Islam. The first stage, not surprisingly, is constituted by the lifetime of the Imam himself, that is to say, down to the beginning of the occultation, a period of about three centuries. And we have, from this time, of course, numerous utterances of the Imams with respect to different verses of the Quran. Two works composed by the Imams themselves on questions of Tafsir. One, that of Imam Ja'far al-Sadiq, which one can call, roughly speaking, Sufi in nature. And by Sufi, I don't mean Sufi in the specific sense of the term, but rather discerns in the verses of the Quran meanings that are, generally speaking, of an inward and spiritual concern. And it is significant that this commentary, although lost in its original form, is contained in extract, not only in Shi'i commentaries upon the Quran, but also in some Sufi commentaries. And then, as you may recall, the 11th of the Imams, Imam Hasan al-Askari, has attributed to him a tafsir on the first two surahs of the Quran, on Surah Al-Fatiha and Surah Al-Baqarah, in which this scheme of zahir and batin, of outer and inward meaning, is followed very rigorously. The second period in the evolution of Shi'i tafsir begins, not surprisingly, with the occultation. And the emergence of the earliest written commentaries by the religious scholars. Out of that emergent possibility, let me select simply one name.
Ali Kubli.
Notice that this one is the Iranian city of Qom. The characteristic of the tafsir of Al-Qumi and of some of his contemporaries is heavy dependence upon hadith. Heavy dependence upon hadith. That is to say, no independent expression of opinion on the meaning of a given verse or group of verses. Instead, concentration simply upon hadith. And of course, bear in mind that hadith here includes sayings of the Prophet and of the Imams. Second characteristic that is to be seen in the tafsir of Al-Qumi is some polemical material directed against the Sunnis, who are questioning the whole validity of the Shia position now that the occultation has brought about the removal of the Imam from immediate access upon earth. It's worth pointing out that here too, in this particular periodization of Shi'i tafsir, we have a parallel with the Sunni development. In other words, the earliest works of Sunni commentary upon the Quran are also not simply based upon, but comprised exclusively hadith from the Prophet and from some of his contemporaries about the meanings of the Quranic verses. If you look, for example, at Tabari,
one of the earliest and most detailed Sunni commentaries upon the Quran,
you can see that it simply is really a compilation of hadith. So if you go there looking for an organized discussion of the meanings of a given word or verse, you will be disappointed at the abuses all of the different hadith. Very occasionally, I put forward his own view on some matter or other, usually not much more than the precise meaning of a given word. And one sees, in the case of Shi'ism, and also at the beginning, a similar reliance upon, an almost exclusive reliance upon hadith. The third stage sees the introduction into the tafsir literature, and again, both Sunni and Shia, of other branches of Islamic learning. Above all, jurisprudence. Why? Because jurisprudence, although it relies on a variety of different sources, as we shall see, goes back in the first place to the relevant verses of the Quran. Questions of theology, i.e., questions such as the nature of the imamate, problems such as predestination, free will, the divine unity, how to relate the multiplicity of divine attributes to the singularity of the divine essence. And similar concerns. In other words, the intellectual development of the broader community, both Sunni and Shi'i, now finds itself reflected in the tafsir literature. So that now more than a simple collection of hadith is to be found in the books of tafsir. However, they still occupy an important place.
Tafsir to emerge. That is composed by Abbasi. A book called, I don't know if there's any point in giving you the end of the title, but these books have been translated into English. Abbasi's book is known as Majma al-Bayan.
Majma al-Bayan. We then come to what might be called the fourth stage or period, which is a very lengthy one. This has been called the period of consolidation. And chronologically speaking, it begins with the rise to supremacy of Shi'ism in Iran under the auspices of the Safavid dynasty at the beginning of the 10th Islamic, the 16th Christian century. This is the first time that Shi'ism attains majority status establishment in a significant territory and does so permanently. So not surprisingly, from the beginning of the Safavid period down to the present,
Iran has, to say the obvious, been the main center of Islamic scholarship, of Shi'i scholarship. And as a result of this consolidation and enrichment, one finds a whole series of different tafsirs being written, above all in Iran, although not exclusively. There are many different types of commentary that emerge in this period. One that we might mention,
written by common scholars of the 17th century,
had a unique method in tafsir. He drew upon the hadith of the Imams, but at the same time was what you might call a Shi'i Sufi. By that I do not mean that he openly calls himself Sufi. In fact, he rejected this title when it was pinned on him by some of his opponents. But he sought to incorporate some of the traditional concerns and even textual legacy of Sufism within the Shi'i framework. So that if one were to read the tafsir of Faiz al-Kashani on many verses of the Quran without knowing the authorship, then one might imagine it to be a tafsir written by a Shi'i commentator, instead of a Sufi commentator upon the Quran. Then we also have a rise of philosophy in the Safavid period, but philosophy of a certain type, which I shall try to define for you later. This too influences the development of tafsir. A reversion to polemics in some other types of tafsir. This might be surprising that we are speaking now of a period of consolidation in which Shi'ism has found a permanent stronghold in Iran. Why then a reversion to one of the characteristics of an earlier period in which polemical arguments are being included in Quran commentaries? Precisely because of the political circumstances of the age, that the propagation of Shi'ism in Iran was to begin with coercive and aroused a strong hostile reaction from the Sunni neighbors of Iran. And the centuries of warfare that then ensued between the Safavids and the Ottomans to the west and various Central Asian dynasties to the east, that took on a sectarian coloring. And as a result of this, polemics received a new lease on life in the literature of both Sunnis and Shi'is. If we come to the modern period, there is one tafsir in particular that demands mention. I mean, we will take the last of the Shi'i commentators that need to be mentioned. Alana, Muhammad Hussein, Tabari. Alama Muhammad Hussein Tabatabai. The commentary that he wrote, so as is here I feel some confidence in giving you the title of the work, because it is in the process of being translated into English, and if some of the bureaucratic obstacles and inefficiencies can be overcome, the first volume should be out, inshallah, within a year in English translation. So Mizan is an extremely important commentary. One can say that it represents the culmination of the whole tradition of Quran commentary in Shia Islam. However, when we say that, we should not assume that is in a narrow sectarian sense a Shi'i commentary. For the following reasons: because it has a number of features that are, as it were, of general interest,
and do not touch upon the specific concerns of Shia Islam. Firstly, Tafsir al-Mizan is the only commentary. This may appear to be a broad and sweeping statement, but it is true, to the best of my knowledge. The only commentary that concerns itself in a serious and consistent way with the structure of the Quran. Virtually every other tafsir, certainly three that I've mentioned here, as well as their Sunni counterparts, deal with the verses of the Quran as discrete units. They're not concerned with the overall development of theme within a given surah. They're not concerned with the structure of a given surah. Still less are they concerned with the relationship of one surah to a preceding one. And after all, from the point of view of Islamic belief, the ordering of the contents of the Quran is not a matter of chance. It has not been done arbitrarily. The ordering of the contents is as much part of the revelation as are the verses and chapters of the Quran. Therefore, it is a very remarkable fact that throughout much of Islamic history, the organization of the Quran, the structure of the Quran, did not receive a great deal of attention. And Allama Tabatabai is the only commentator to have taken this matter in any way seriously. And he begins his commentary upon each surah with an overview of its contents and then divides up the verses of that particular chapter into segments, each of which has a theme. A second important characteristic of the Tafsir al-Mizan is that he regards the primary source for the understanding of the Quran to be the Quran itself. In other words, the understanding of each verse of the Quran is in the first place to be approached by means of comparison with, correlation with, all other relevant verses. This is a characteristic or a method which goes back to the Imams themselves. Imam Ali is on record as having said that the Quran should be interpreted by means of the Quran, which yields us to the somewhat surprising, perhaps contradictory conclusion that the place of Hadith in the Tafsir al-Mizan is quite marginal. Although the authority of the Imams, as we have stressed repeatedly, is extremely great from the point of view of Shia Islam, the hadith in the commentary of al-Mizan have a secondary position. In fact, Tabatabai first presents his analysis of a certain block of verses based upon a close reading of them and a comparison with all related passages elsewhere in the Quran, and then secondarily, clearly separated, he has what he calls a battery away, a discussion of the relevant hadith. And in many cases, he rejects the authority of the hadith in question. Because, again, of a principle going back to the Imams, that if any hadith appears to be in contradiction to the Quran, it must of necessity be false. It must of necessity be false. And therefore, a large number of hadith, even those which Shi'i tradition has regarded as authentic and acceptable, are rejected by Tabatabai. Tabatabai, we will encounter in other contexts, particularly the context of philosophy as cultivated in Shi'ism. And it may be said that his primary temperament is as a philosopher. So that his approach to the Quran, although comprehensive, he includes legal, historical, logical, even mystical dimension, so is primarily that of a philosopher. It is therefore a closely written and well-argued text. So, this is an overview of the development of Tafsir in Shia Islam. We turn now, I think I have, no, I guess I don't, I might as well take off. I don't turn to anything, but yeah, there are only a few minutes left. So hadith will remain for our consideration on Thursday.